AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters this Sunday, July 25, 2010. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. Frequent listeners of this program know that our news media system is having its travails and its problems as we go through this new century with the internet, with business challenges, with all sorts of problems that beset it. Today we're having as our guest one of the great constitutional authorities to talk about his ideas for where the First Amendment and freedom of the press stand in the United States today, where we've come from, and where we need to go if we're going to have a credible free press and a credible system of self-governance, not just in the United States, but in the world. Should be a terrific show, so please sit back, relax, and enjoy us. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. In 2007, a rare window opened up at the Federal Communications Commission for new full-power non-commercial radio stations. Hundreds of nonprofit organizations applied for these licenses, and over the past several years, the FCC has been handing out construction permits to the few fortunate communities where space was still open on the broadcast dial. But a critical government program that news stations have historically relied upon to help with expensive startup costs has been targeted by the Obama administration as one way to cut the national deficit. The Public Telecommunications Facilities Program, or PTFP, provides funding for non-commercial radio stations to purchase or upgrade equipment, transmitters, and hardware. And unlike the funding provided to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, more stations are eligible to receive funds through PTFP. Loris Ann Taylor is the executive director of Native Public Media, an organization that works with Native communities to expand and strengthen their access to media, such as radio and broadband.
This is very important for tribal communities because most tribal communities, as you know, are off the broadband grid. They are in places where 911 services are non-existent. They are in places where transportation corridors are still dirt roads, and they are really in locations that are remote and rural. And so for these communities, terrestrial radio stations really work.
Native Public Media worked with more than 50 tribes to help them apply for a radio station license. 38 of those applicants received construction permits from the FCC. But without the PTFP funding, many of these stations may be forced to abandon their operations before they even get on the air.
PTFP funding is the only source of money that's available for new applicants to apply for. It's a matching grant that supplies up to 75% of the construction dollars. And these dollars go primarily towards the design and planning of new stations and for the actual physical construction of studios. And so to lose PTFP funding is going to be really significant for the Native American communities who still lag behind in the broadcasting industry, who are really invisible in terms of media and who face a huge media divide.
Grassroots lobbying efforts seem to be working. Just this week, the appropriations subcommittees in the House and Senate voted to restore the funding. Taylor expresses hope that the full Congress will vote to save the program. And now a special guest commentary from Nick Rousseau, intern with Free Press and program director at WMUA.
My career in radio broadcasting, though relatively short, has deep roots. I grew up in a family which almost exclusively listened to public radio, valued varied tastes in music, and encouraged artistic, musical, social, and political exploration. I spent hours listening to the radio, taking in every bit of news I could and wondering how radio broadcasting worked. I dreamed someday to be at the controls of a big mixing board, twisting knobs and talking into a microphone for the whole world to hear. Little did I know then that when I got a bit older, I'd be working as program director at my college radio station and studying the impact community media and low-power FM radio each have on their communities. The United States seems to have lost focus on localism, The news and information we get on a daily basis is provided by national and global reporting outfits. We rarely encounter quality locally based journalism. Luckily, something can be done to significantly alter our media landscape and make localism in media a prerogative. Congress can expand low-power FM radio by passing the Local Community Radio Act of 2009. Low-power FM stations are a category of non-commercial radio stations which were created by the FCC largely in response to the need for more local voices on the airwaves. However, soon after this service was created, big media companies raised concern that these small, locally owned and operated radio stations would interfere with their huge, nationally reaching radio networks, and therefore no new licenses have been granted since the last window in the early 2000s. Now, the Local Community Radio Act is waiting to be approved by the Senate. The passage of this bill will enable communities to have access to important hyperlocal news and information during natural disasters. Listeners will be able to hear their neighbors, local politicians, church leaders, and children on the airwaves. And best of all, we won't be force-fed the same junk media wherever we go because the airwaves will be ultimately more diverse than they have ever been before. We must urge our senators to pass the Local Community Radio Act so we can return to the localism that has been missing in our media for far too long.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Coming to you live today, July 25th, 2010. Our guest today will not remember the story I'm about to tell you, unless he has the world's most extraordinary memory. But some two decades ago, when I occupied what is probably the lowest rung on the research university pecking order, I was an assistant professor of communications at a research university over 1,000 miles away from Saltwater. I sent a letter to our guest with a couple of copies of articles I'd written on legal matters, since our guest at that time was the dean of the Michigan Law School and one of the foremost experts in the First Amendment. And to my great surprise, he wrote back a very encouraging and supportive letter to me, for which I've always been grateful. And this is my first opportunity to thank him. Our guest today is the president today of Columbia University, Lee C. Bollinger. Also an expert on the First Amendment, has written numerous books on the First Amendment and especially freedom of the press. And we're going to be discussing his brand new book, Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open, A Free Press for a New Century, just published by Oxford University Press. Today on our program, Professor Dr. Bollinger, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob, for having me.
And do you remember that letter you sent me?
I'm afraid I don't, but of course I
yeah,
know
I would have, you. It would have been astounding had you remembered it, given the circumstances.
Yeah.
You've been writing widely about press issues, obviously, in addition to being president of Columbia since 2002. So I thank you for your work, and I thank you for taking time from what I can only imagine is an extraordinarily busy schedule to join us today on Media Matters.
My pleasure.
Well, let's start with the title of the book, which comes from one of the most famous opinions in Supreme Court history, but still many of our listeners might not be familiar with it. Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open. What does that refer to, and why is that the title of your book?
Well, as you indicate, it comes from one of the most famous Supreme Court cases of the last century, New York Times versus Sullivan in 1964. There are several reasons why I want to make reference to it. I think one is because it captures where the First Amendment ended up in that century. The most extraordinary protections for speech and press of any country in the world and probably in the history of the world. And New York Times versus Sullivan sort of grounded that commitment in an even deeper principle of sovereignty lying with citizens and the people really having the final authority in the democracy. And that case also did something which I think is incredibly important for today, and that is it took a local, in this case state of Alabama, libel law, which had been in that case applied to the New York Times for a few hundred copies that had been distributed in Alabama. And the Supreme Court said that the libel laws of individual states, individual jurisdictions, had to conform to the constitutional principle that speech on public matters would have to be uninhibited. We would want to be uninhibited, robust, and wide open. And it was a moment in time when not only did the court commit the country to the most extraordinary protections, but it also said that we're a national society with a national public forum, and the individual states, as important as local control is, would have to give way to a national public forum that had these basic characteristics. What I say in this book is that we're now at the stage where that's true on a global scale. Mm-hmm. And so what happened in New York Times, I think, now has to be played out in the context of global issues of free speech and free press.
President Bollinger, thank you again for joining us. And I do want to ask you, in your book, you talk about how it really wasn't until 1919, 140 years or so after the Republic began, that the U.S. Supreme Court formally discussed what freedom of the press means in the First Amendment. And you sort of suggest that really you leave me wondering, what did we have in the first 140 years of American history? Did we have a free press then? Why wasn't this a federal case? Why weren't there Supreme Court cases on freedom of the press in 1820 or 1880?
It's a great question, and the answer is we don't know the answer. Those of us who, like yourself, who have worked in the area of free press and free speech, whenever we teach it, we begin with these first Supreme Court cases in 1919, Schenck, Froerk, and Debs. And as you indicate, there's no cases between the time the First Amendment's adopted in the late 18th century until 1919. Now, why that's so, again, we just don't know. It seemed to be a matter in which local authority and local power to control and the limits of speech was something that was just rooted in American culture. Of course, the 14th Amendment wasn't adopted as part of the Constitution until after the Civil War, and that's what made the First Amendment applicable to the states. So one might say, well, there just wasn't a constitutional reach before that. But I think it's a more profound question of just how important is free speech, free press to a society. And I think in the 19th century, people just didn't regard it as crucial as we did in the came to feel in the 20th century.
Is there a tradition in the 19th century, say in the late 19th century after the 14th Amendment was passed, to put a finer point on it, where newspaper editors or publishers around the country were getting rounded up by local governments for stuff they wrote? Do we have much of a history where there were violations of publishers and editors' First Amendment rights?
We do. I mean, I think there were, of course, the classic areas of obscenity and defamation and blasphemy. There were many areas, subversion. There are many stories of what we would regard as violations of free speech, free press occurring through the 19th century. At the same time, there's no question that these principles were deeply embedded in American society. It's just that it did not have the centrality in American life that it came to have to possess in this last century. I think everybody now today understands the general contours of free speech, free press principles. That's an amazing thing in itself. And the fact that there are so many cases now since 1919, there are hundreds of cases, and almost every single year the Supreme Court decides yet another case or more. It's very elaborate, very refined. It is really the first principle, we often say, of American culture, political institutions, and democracy. It's really the first, symbolized by being the First Amendment. And I think that is something that is much more a 20th century phenomenon. And then the question is, why did that happen? And I think that's very much rooted in the development of a national society where national issues having to do with the economy, having to do with civil rights, equality, environment, criminal procedure, across the board in the last century, the courts articulated a set of constitutional parameters for an emerging national society.
Our guest today on Media Matters is President Lee Bollinger of Columbia University, also a leading First Amendment and Freedom of the Press scholar in the United States, who has written a new book, Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open, A Free Press for a New Century, which we're discussing today, about the great crisis of news media in the United States and what sort of future we need to have if we're serious about self-government and the rule of law. It's a book I learned a great deal from, and I think anyone who's interested in getting a sort of sense of the constitutional tradition of freedom of the press in the United States could do little better than to start here to get an introduction into the great themes of that tradition. People wishing to call in and speak with Professor Bollinger, the telephone number here at Media Matters and WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. President Bollinger, one question I always get, and I know you talk about it in the book, is, you know, why is freedom of the press in the First Amendment, since it seems to be the same thing as freedom of speech? Isn't it redundant?
Well, we, again, I'm afraid, have very little evidence to go on as to the intention of the framers. A lot of people, including justices on the Supreme Court, speak about original intent. What did the framers of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights really mean? The fact is we really know very, very little about that. If you follow ordinary kind of logic in interpreting language and text, I think one would probably conclude that by adding free press and not just making free speech the sole textual statement, that the framers thought that a free press had some kind of special role in the democracy. And that's certainly how it came to be perceived through the constitutional interpretations of the First Amendment in the last century. That is, the conventional view today was really ensconced in our constitutional interpretation through cases like New York Times versus Sullivan, where the court recognized again and again that the press has a public role to play, a fourth branch of government, a watchdog of government, a way of informing citizens about great issues of the time that they're responsible for resolving. So the kind of institutional role of the press as part of a working democracy has become a standard theme, and there are good reasons to think that, even on slim evidence, that is what the framers intended.
President Bollinger, your book makes a strong case throughout that one of the great developments in the 20th century that enhanced press freedom in the United States was the emergence of the notion of professional journalism, which is only a century old, really, in the United States. And I wonder if you could just explain why that is so important and what that means for us going forward today.
Well, I think it's a very important question. If we start from today, I think we're in a period, or we're entering a period, where the very institutions of the press, the media, that we have come to accept and know as part of American life, New York Times, the great broadcast networks, Washington Post, LA Times, all across the country, these great and now longstanding institutions, they are under some financial threat or insecurity. And that's largely, as everybody knows, it's because of the emergence of the Internet and the fragmenting of opportunities for advertisers and readers to get information. So we're at a moment when we have to ask a question that we just sort of took for granted before. And that question is there anything special, really important for the society in having institutions of the press? And I don't mean we really must have the New York Times, just that we need institutions like the New York Times or the Washington Post. And to my mind, the answer is yes, but just posing the question, you say, well, what do journalists do, especially those who work for large press institutions, that other people don't do? And I think the same thing we would ask about scholars and universities. What does scholarship do for the society that other parts of the society don't do? And I think the answer in the case of journalism is that it is a group of people who, generally speaking, commit themselves to providing independent, objective, significantly non-ideological information about what is happening in the world to the public. Now, one can go on. That's obviously a very cursory way of saying something that I think is quite real and quite important. But there is a sense, I believe, that journalists have evolved not just into people who express their opinions about things, but at their best, it is a profession where people do, where they restrain their own, perhaps, impulses to say what they want to say. And they report independent, objective, nonpartisan information about what's happening in the world to us, the public. And that would be a great loss if we didn't have that. If there were just open discussion, everybody said what they liked, there'd be a rich, we want that, but it's more in the nature of exchange of opinion and ideas than it is in the reporting of information in an objective way.
Do you think that, to ask a blunt question, do you think that the owners of the firms that now house what remains of our news media, do you think, that they're committed to that type of journalism if it interferes with their ability to satisfy shareholders?
Well, this becomes, this hits at the core of an idea. I think the answer, just to start there, to the question is, still largely yes. That is, I happen to sit on the board of the Washington Post Company. I know for a fact, my own knowledge, that the Washington Post continues to view their responsibilities and their role in that way. I'm sure people at the New York Times do, so on around the country. My sense is, however, that if you leave, and this is a big problem, if you leave the press solely to the marketplace of, to the free market, if you say that what we should have is just whatever people are prepared to pay for and whatever people can make into a business, my own view is that in all likelihood that professional journalism will experience a significant decline. I think, in all honesty, we have to say we don't know whether that's true, but we don't know that it's not true. There are many people who argue today very vociferously that the press should be whatever the free market determines. I'm inclined to think that the press, in its professional, sort of constitutionally defined role, is a public good, and public goods, by definition, it's a concept that reflects there are some things that the market simply cannot, will not provide. And so I think that's one of the big questions for the time. As the market starts to dominate more and more, the free market, what we're experiencing in journalism, I think we're probably going to get less of that professional journalism we were just talking about and more of the kind of partisan opinion offering kind of speech than we've experienced so far. And I think that would be a big loss.
Our guest today in Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Professor and President Lee Bollinger from Columbia University, one of the leading First Amendment and Freedom of the Press experts in the United States, author of the new book, Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open, A Free Press for a New Century, just published by Oxford University Press. He's also been writing for The Wall Street Journal and The Chronicle of Higher Education on these issues. If you have a question or comment for President Bollinger, the phone number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455, and we welcome your calls with questions and comments. There's a lot to talk about in this book because it has a good deal of history and a lot of First Amendment history, as well as addressing the crisis we're in today going forward and what the courts can do and what we as a society can do to rejuvenate journalism along the lines that we've been talking about so far in the program. Professor Bollinger, one of the things I've had the privilege of doing this summer is reread Walter Lippmann. And I think it's of particular importance because Lippmann wrote two great essays in 1919 and 1920. One was called A Test of the News, which he wrote with Charles Merz in The New Republic. And the other was Liberty in the News, which were three essays he wrote and put together in a short book. And they were really probably the strongest critique of existing journalism then written in the United States. And a very strong call for not just professional journalism, professional standards like you've talked about, but also public participation in a way that goes against professionalism in the sense that the public shouldn't just leave it to professionals, but should actually be involved in the news as well. And what it was striking to me as I read these books this summer is that Lippmann's obsession with the need for professional journalism was that without it, the news was going to be entirely dependent upon people in power, press releases, public relations, what he called propaganda, to sort of frame the world, especially in foreign policy, and that it would be professional journalism that would sort of get us out of that because independent, trained professional journalists. And I thought of that this week when the Washington Post published an extraordinary series on the extent of the secret government in the United States. I'm sure you're very familiar with the piece. Until Andrew Breitbart came along, it got a lot of attention for about 4 hours. And what was striking about it was how unusual that piece was, that this, you know, it's almost the exception that proves the rule. And you write about this in the book, the whole tension between a free press and sort of a national security state. How do we get around that?
How do we get around that tension?
Yeah. What can we do to keep what in the United States today is an extraordinarily large secretive part of our government accountable in any way? It seems that, you know, our news media, with the exceptions that prove the rule, are largely incapable or not pursuing investigations on the national security military apparatus beyond what people, official sources, want to talk about.
Right. Well, of course, this again is a really, really difficult, complicated issue. So I say several things. One is that the story you referred to is, as you say, a perfect example of the kind of, quote, reporting journalism that I think is significantly related to the existence of very large press institutions. So it took 2 years of commitment by the Washington Post for those reporters to be out there looking and gathering data and so on. And this is probably not the kind of work that researchers, scholars in universities are going to do. There's an imperfect but still a kind of division of labor between what our great universities do in the way of research, kind of questions they pose and answer, and the work that's done by journalists. And journalists are much more in the thick of things of the moment. Scholars tend to be more reflective on broader issues. And those are two things we really need in the society. I mean, if we, just to put it bluntly, a great democracy depends upon having very, very important flows of information. If we don't have that, then we're steadily drifting into some kind of state, probably an authoritarian kind. But certainly, it is information that's the first principle or the first need of a democracy. You need these institutions. They can't, I believe, be created by a free market itself. Our universities are not the result of free markets by any means. And institutions of the press, I think, as we have them today, are also not the product of the free market, but we can get to that. The point is, this is really the essence of a democracy, and we shouldn't take it in any sense lightly. Now, it poses a very deep question in this particular story, and you've properly generalized from it. The government is responsible for keeping us secure, making sure that our enemies do not get the upper hand, and keeping us safe so that we can go about our lives. To do that, they need a certain amount, the government needs a certain amount of secrecy. Obviously, people who work as spies and agents and diplomatic moves behind the scenes, all of that requires a certain level of privacy and secrecy. On the other hand, we also know that the government almost always overplays its hand when it comes to keeping things secret. Power just seems to like to operate more in secret than it does in public view. And so you have this problem of a need, but a problem that it becomes overly zealous. And that then intrudes into the need of the public for information. The press, the way the Supreme Court has kind of worked this out is interesting, and I recount this in the book. Essentially, it came up with a very muddled kind of response, but one that's worked reasonably well. And what the court said in the Pentagon Papers case, the Pentagon Papers being the history of the Vietnam War that the Nixon administration tried to stop the publication of, the Supreme Court said, look, the press cannot force the government to hand over information that it thinks the public needs. And we as courts are not going to go through an elaborate evaluation of the government's claim of secrecy and so on. But if the press gets their hands on the information, the government will not be able to stop them, absent some really extreme kinds of risks that the society would face with publication. And that set up a something of a contest between the government and the press that has lasted to this day. So if I'm a journalist, I want to find out what's happening with private vendors working in for the CIA, as the story does. I can't force the CIA to hand over that information, but if I get it through a leak or otherwise, the government can't stop me from publishing it. And that's an interesting kind of an American, very pragmatic way of approaching this problem.
In the book, you argue that we need to really rethink that, though, don't you?
I do.
That doesn't work anymore?
It's probably time for a number of reasons, but I think it's time that the court begin to recognize or create a process by which these kinds of questions of access to information on the part of the press can be evaluated and possibly order the government to hand it over. I say that in the book because I'm particularly concerned with the problem the press faces in getting information in foreign policy matters, and in particular in wars. So during the Iraq War, there are many examples of where it was exceedingly difficult for the press to cover what was happening, and in the Afghanistan War, too. And I think it's really important for the court to begin to intervene in that and to lay some rules down.
Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, is President Lee Bollinger from Columbia University, also one of the leading First Amendment experts in the United States, author of the new book, Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open, a free press for a new century, just published by Oxford University Press. The phone lines are open here at Media Matters, 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our phone lines now and go to our first caller, who's been very patient. Line 4, Muhammad, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Lee Bollinger.
Yes, I have two questions. You say that we should be open and unfettered, and yet you know, and I know, that you're not allowed to use the N-word, and you're not allowed to say anything anti-Semitic in this country, or you get blasted left and right. Also, the second point is, I listen to the BBC all the time, and the CBC, the Canadian, and I hear many, many things on their networks that I never hear in this country. Please, I'll hang up and listen for your reply.
Thank you very much, caller. Dr. Bollinger?
Well, it's interesting because you used the term that was used, that you get blasted, I think was the term. If you put it in the First Amendment, one of the things that's quite striking about what has happened to free speech, free press in this country is that anti-Semitic speech, racist speech, neo-Nazi speech, speech advocating genocide, all of that has been and is largely protected. It is an amazing fact about American society that we stand alone in the world in the degree to which we take free speech and prize it over other competing values, this is really a very important thing. So in fact, if you look in terms of government intervention in speech and the limits that the First Amendment puts on it, it cannot prohibit or punish people for saying really terrible things, whether it's racist or anti-Semitic or subversive, and so on. With respect to the BBC and the CBC, I don't. The caller didn't give an example or examples of things that are said. My own view is that BBC has developed and the Canadian Broadcasting Service have developed into very fine journalism and institutions of journalism, and we're all the better for having them. They are publicly funded, very important to realize that. They're not the product of the free market. You can argue that they're too big, too much support, and so on, and you can argue that they take some positions that are wrong. Putting all that aside, I think there's a wide consensus that these are very fine journalistic institutions. The question for us, I think, is are we out there in the world, are our media out there in the world competing with the other media institutions from other nations for the kinds of perspectives on issues and information that we value? And I argue in the book, and I've argued in other venues, that we really need to rethink the Cold War system we have, where NPR and PBS and stations like this one have wonderful journalistic values and perform great service for the country, but have very limited roles in the global marketplace of ideas and very little capacity, relatively speaking, to BBC, for example, in being out there getting information. We have a Cold War created set of institutions like Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, that are there, but they are, by their very nature and structure, more in the nature of propaganda institutions, although they do some very good journalism, I want to add, but they will always be perceived as the U.S. government position on things. And my view is we should be creating an American World Service that's very much like on the model of the BBC and the BBC World Service, but with American journalism, independent journalism, based in NPR and PBS out there competing for our perspectives on things.
Our guest, Lee Ballinger, you've just been listening to, the president of Columbia University, the author of Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open. We have a bank of callers waiting patiently to speak with you, Professor Ballinger, so let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Ballinger. It's great to hear you, and it's great to, as I'm listening to your wide-ranging discussion, my question keeps jumping from one subject to another subject to another subject because you're being very comprehensive, and I love listening to everything you and Bob are having to say. I was going to ask you, and maybe we don't have any more situations in the United States where this is apparent, as far as freedom of the press and the consolidation of our print press through joint operating agreements, or JOAs, and the effect it's having on the freedom of the press. But going right back to just what you were saying with regards to the BBC, radio and television, Deutsche Welle, all of these other independent, publicly funded press organizations throughout the world. And about the only thing I could, and I loved what you were saying with regards to gaining access within our own country from our own federal government information, and with what should be the freedom of the press and the ability to go ahead and report things like the Pentagon Papers. It seems like our system of journalism has had to rely more so on the likes of WikiLeaks to provide the information that not everything being conducted in our name is entirely appropriate. But the only way we're going to gain access or information is by such organizations providing us with the reality of what's going on around the world. But you can pick any one of those that I'm just astonished by.
Right.
But I'd love to hear what your observations. Is that what we've, as far as investigative journalism, is that what we're journalists in the United States are having to resort to in order to be able to follow up?
Right. Well, we have.
Thank you, caller.
Yep.
In listening to you, I find myself thinking this is a really complex subject, and and one can get one can just see all kinds and feel all kinds of issues emerging. That's why I spent much of my life doing this and written this book, because I think it's so important. But going back to where you began, so the point about joint operating agreements, that was from the 1950s and 60s, and it was in a period when newspapers were becoming monopolies, and they did across 90%+ of every city, community in the country had one daily newspaper, when in the earlier part of the century there'd be multiple newspapers. That fact about the monopoly position of newspapers is a very important one. Obviously, from a free speech, free press perspective, monopolies are never very good because we believe that having multiple voices is going to give us a better marketplace of ideas.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines if we can, because we have a couple callers waiting very patiently.
All right.
Line two, Coles County, you're on the air with President Lee Ballinger of Columbia University.
Yes, I thought I'd just mention, in the long run, in the future, it seems to me that some of these entities, like the New York Times, perhaps, should move toward ownership by, and foundations might be involved in this, but should move toward ownership through some kind of a trust fund, some kind of a trust that would own the newspaper and at least partially fund it. It seems to me that that's the most viable thing for, not for all newspapers, of course, but for a few, like the New York Times. And the setup probably would be somewhat similar to the BBC. What is your comment on that?
Thank you very much, caller. Professor Ballinger?
Well, I do think that we need to have more public funding of certain kinds of journalism. That is, I would greatly increase our funding of NPR and PBS, and I would also give them the assignment of becoming global media. As far as the New York Times and the Washington Post and some other, we still don't know whether they will find a viable business model in the new environment of the Internet generally. I am optimistic that there will be places for these institutions. I am also optimistic that they will retain their professional journalistic roots, but it is going to be very difficult. If they don't, then I think we really do have to think about ways in which we, as a society, are going to provide greater support for them. And through nonprofit status, that's one, or through public funding, that's another. You know, universities, again, are not in the free market. Columbia University doesn't have shareholders, and we don't have to turn a profit in order to match the shareholders' interests. So we have to approach this very, very watchfully and carefully. But for the moment, I think if we had a greater commitment of public funding for our public broadcasting system and gave it a larger global mandate, I think that would be a very good start. And then we can see over the next several years how the other branches of the media fare in this new environment.
Yeah, Professor Bollinger, as I was just listening to you now and as I read your Wall Street Journal piece a week or two ago when it appeared, it seems in a way that as a society, the discussion has really moved pretty dramatically towards an opening to sort of having an honest assessment of what public funding is, rather than what for most of my adult life, and I suspect yours, has been pretty much a, I would say, knee-jerk reaction against public funding as something by definition that is antithetical to our press freedom tradition. And when I read your book, I saw what I would regard as a much more nuanced and evidence-based treatment of the subject than a knee-jerk-based one. Do you sense there's a change going on?
Well, I think it's very important that there be a change, and I think there are some people now beginning to advocate this, as I am doing. But I still think we're in an environment that is, as you described, is kind of just an instinctive resistance to this. And I think it's not just a resistance based on a formed opinion. I think it's based on inadequate information and unwillingness to really understand reality. The press we have today is not the product of a free market. As I said, monopolies, newspapers were monopolies. Broadcasting was a mixed system of private and public regulation and, of course, public broadcasting. And all of this has produced a very, very strong press. I mean, I think we have the strongest press of any country in the world. But as that begins to dissolve, that is, the free market begins to take over, we really have to think very carefully about the mix of public funding and private market kind of press we're going to have and need. The circumstances have definitely changed. They've changed on a global scale, and they've changed in a market sense. We better start thinking about this very seriously, I think.
Our guest today, Professor Lee Bollinger, president of Columbia University, author of Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open, a free press for a new century, just published by Oxford University Press. The phone number here at WILL-AM580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air.
Thank you, and I can totally agree with all you're saying, and what comes to mind recently about freedom of the press, except it was in a Rolling Stones article that led to General McChrystal's uninhibited, robust, and wide-open discussion in that article to his demise and unfortunate good criticism about our practices, and also to remind us in the previous administration, any differing viewpoints by military or other people with the Defense Department and State Department was met with rebuff and almost dismissal of those parties also. But I'm reminded of the fact of Abraham Lincoln having many people of diverse, extreme different positions on his cabinet to deal with the matter and so on and so on. So you have to drift to what I'm saying. But what comes to mind in an open press conference that the president may have, any reporter that stands up and says something that may be a little too uninhibited, robust, and wide open, suddenly is relegated to the hinterlands for having brought it up. So thank you very much for all you're doing. Very much. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, caller. We've got a couple callers waiting patient. Let's go right back to the phone lines. Now let's go to line one, Slaterville, New York. Welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for taking my call. So, Dr. Bollinger, I'd like to go back to a comment a previous caller had made about WikiLeaks. And I'm wondering, you know, given that the access to information is just clearly necessary for the proper function of a democratic society, and that it's so hard to get information through the things like Freedom of Information Act when the government is clearly wanting it suppressed, I just wonder what your opinion of this method, the WikiLeaks method, is. Thank you.
Well, I think we have, by design, that's what I was saying a little while ago, or I should say by choice, we have a very almost messy system. Rather than having an administrative or judicial process whereby information can be looked at, gauged, the government's argument that it needs to keep it secret, and the public's argument that it needs to know this information. Rather than having that, we have a really battle that goes on daily with the press and other institutions and other parties and individuals, all trying to get hold of documents that are government documents. Maybe they're classified, maybe not. Or to get people to leak information, which is a crime, actually, under the Espionage Act. And there's a really an amazing kind of array of activities all trying to get the information from the government that the government doesn't want to hand over. On the whole, I think it is a system that, as I said earlier, and as I say in the book, has worked reasonably well. I think pretty hard to point to very many circumstances where the society has been significantly harmed by over leaking of information. I think it's much more, however, likely, many more examples one could come up with where the government has over classified and kept too much away from the public. And that's why I think we probably need a stronger hand on the side of the press in having access to information. So that's a complicated issue. There are dozens of things to say about it. But I think I would say for this century, opening up that issue, which the court refused to do in the last century, is probably a good way to go.
Dr. Bollinger, James Madison and some of his most famous writings on freedom and self-government argued that it was, and I'm paraphrasing here, it was impossible to remain a nation permanently at war and remain a republic. The two were contradictory eventually. And is there a great tension here, possibly, just between our massive military presence in the world and trying to maintain an open society? I mean, are these two at some point ultimately incompatible?
Well, it's a great question. I've said now several times, and you know, Bob, that the doctrines of the First Amendment, the scope of free speech, free press, that we have today is the product of a number of Supreme Court decisions, but only beginning in 1919. Those cases in 1919 were not a good set of doctrines for free speech. In fact, people were unanimously, the court rejected their First Amendment claims, and people went to jail for things that we now would regard as just standard free speech rights. That happened. So World War I is a real low point in the history of our society and protection of speech. When the McCarthy era emerged, there again, we know that the courts collapsed significantly in their protections of free speech and free press. During the Vietnam era, that's when the courts began to intervene and establish the doctrines, the strong protections that we have today. I think during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, we have held up not perfectly by any means, but better than we have in other historical periods. What we have learned from this, I think, or what we should learn, is that any time the nation is at war or feels threatened, almost certainly free speech and free press are going to come under assault. And it is an open question whether we have the will and the constitutional process to be able to withstand the pressures that emerge in those periods. So I think it's an open question whether Madison, which you quoted, is right or wrong. I myself am ambivalent about it, but I think it's a deep, profound question for the society.
Let's go back to our phone lines for our final caller, showing the international presence that Media Matters has assumed. We have a call on line two from Marseille, Illinois.
I basically respect what you guys are saying, but I don't understand. The government and the press are basically in an adversarial relationship, and I don't understand why the press would want to be financed by the government. I don't know if you guys saw the gun camera footage where a journalist in Iraq was killed that was released on the internet with a chain gun underneath the helicopter. It was horrifying. There were seven or eight men standing on a street, and they opened up on them for no reason with a chain gun and shot a guy who was hiding behind a cinder block wall. And it came out through the internet, I guess from some internet site in Sweden. And now the individual that released that footage is in jail, as I understand it. And the press's job is to watch what governments and corporations do. And I don't understand how the press can be financed by the government and in the same, you know, role watching what the government does. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Dr. Bollinger?
Well, I think that is the central issue in any kind of public funding for the press. I think the, again, many things to say about it. You have to ask, in an advertiser-supported world, which is one of the things we've had, there are also going to be efforts by the advertisers to control what's said, and we know that that's a pressure that not all the press has responded to properly. In a system that is run by very wealthy people, that too poses problems of distortions. So any system you come up with is going to have the risk of distortions. Public funding is something we have had in this country. It's not as if it's entirely new. The question is the degree to which we commit ourselves to it. On the whole, NPR and PBS have had a good history, I think, of standing up to the government and reporting on issues. And there are ways in which to fortify that. I think we could do even better on a constitutional principle that protects them against any kind of government intervention in the nature of censorship. So you can build some constitutional walls protecting them. And there are other things you can do as well. I think that if you look around the world and you look at something like BBC or BBC World Service, you have some good examples of where a publicly funded system produces very high-quality journalism.
Lee Bollinger, our guest today. I want to thank you very much, President Bollinger, for joining us. I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio.
Yep.
Lee Bollinger is the author of the brand new book, Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open, A Free Press for a New Century, just published by Oxford University Press. President Bollinger, thank you very much for taking time from your schedule to join us today.
Thank you very much, Bob.
And I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kaya Kroha, for working the board. And please join me here at Media Matters in 167 hours. Our guest next week, Larry Lessig from Harvard Law School, will be talking about corruption and governance in the United States. Please be with us then. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
It'll be partly sunny, a little bit cooler, and less humid today in and around Champaign-Urbana with a high of 85. Partly cloudy tonight, low 63. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, a high of 84. Partly sunny and a high of 88 on Tuesday. Wind today from the north to northwest at 5 to 10. This is Illinois Public Media, WI.